Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Michael Chakraborty.
And I'm Mark Watson.
And welcome back to Menkind, where we chat to a range of brilliant guests about masculinity.
Some of them are men, some of them aren't men, and some of them aren't particularly bothered either way.
We're interested in men.
Yes, obviously you are.
And what makes them tick? Where does masculinity come from? How does it affect us? And how could we be better?
We might not get a final answer, but we'll have a bloody good go at it. Won't we, Michael?
Oh, we'll do our best.
Happy New Week, everybody. Well, I'm Mark Watson, sometimes regarded as quite a sort of hard-living, hard-drinking character, and Michael can come across quite sort of soft and benign. But here we have a role reversal. I am in my parents' living room, and Michael is wrecked. Is that fair, Michael?
I would say so. I'm a husk of a man, decaying from the inside. I went to Manchester for the weekend. And
what he means is he's been out in Manchester, yeah.
Canal Street is rotten, but I'm having a lovely little decompress now.
That's what Michael's been doing. Well, I've been drinking sherry with Chris and Margaret Watson. So who's the bad boy now?
Oh, we're all bad boys in our own way. And talking of bad boys, although who knows whether they're a boy or anything, really, it's Jamie. Hello, Jamie, who's joined us on the Menkind Patreon. Lovely to have you with us. Had the best of Mondays, I suppose, is what we say.
That was a delightful forced segue. We've got no evidence that Jamie regards himself as a bad boy or, as you say, a boy. But still, welcome, Jamie.
Welcome, Jamie. And also this week, we welcome lovely Freddie McConnell to the podcast.
As you'll remember, if you were listening last week, Freddie's story is a remarkable one. He is a trans man who gave birth, as chronicled in the film Seahorse, about him, which we set as homework last week, and some of you will have watched it, but it doesn't matter whether you have, you're going to just sit back and enjoy what I think was a pretty unusual conversation.
So enjoy the episode, as I'm sure you will.
I think you will.
So this week, Mark's here, always is, and Freddie's here. Hello, Freddie McConnell. Who are you, please?
Hello. Thank you for having me. Well, I guess I will now attempt to introduce myself. I'm a writer and a journalist by trade. I'm a dad. That's sort of what takes up most of my time these days. And I'm a trans man and queer, just for good measure.
A nice dollop of queerness to pop on the top. Lovely.
Yeah.
I feel like I should say thanks for having me to you as well, Michael, because that was the skimpiest intro you've ever given me. You just said Mark's here, barely even acknowledging. Anyway.
Would you like to introduce yourself, Mark?
No. Listeners are familiar with me. Let's get back to Freddie. And Freddie, the circumstances in which you became a dad are one of the big things you're known for, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, sure. It's always hard to know where to start because there's various starting points in this process. Mm. So yeah, I started to transition medically in my mid-20s. And at that point, was under the impression that transition would make me infertile. That's what I was effectively told by doctors. Thought that for a few years and then discovered through community online that that wasn't true. And then wrestled for a couple more years with the idea of could I pause my transition and maybe go off testosterone and conceive and be pregnant like I've seen other guys doing? Then eventually realized, yes, I think I can do that. I've got support of my family and I was in quite a good place with my career. I'd been a journalist for a few years then. So yeah, that's what I did. I stopped testosterone, conceived and had my son in 2018 by myself. I was a solo parent by choice. And still am.
Well, there are a lot of aspects of the story that are real eye-openers. Is it still true to say, do you think, that most people undergoing transition believe that it'll make them infertile? It seems from everything I've read about you that that is a pretty commonly accepted thing, which is astonishing. I mean, the difference between that being true and not being true is life-changing.
Mm. 100%. I mean, from my perspective and from the perspective of my community, it's very hard not to see it as a huge scandal and a human rights violation.
Yeah.
I mean, in some countries, transition is only kind of granted if you are forcibly sterilized. In other words, you have a hysterectomy, we've never had that rule in this country. And the government sometimes likes to kind of brag about that as if it's sort of a big achievement, but they just sort of conveniently overlook the fact that NHS doctors are still effectively telling trans men, they might not be explicit about it, but there's a consent form that you sign when you start testosterone, which sort of says, you know, I acknowledge that this may make me infertile. So you kind of then have to unpick that. And really what it is there's no evidence that testosterone causes infertility. And now there is an increasing, exponentially increasing amount of evidence that it doesn't, in the shape of people like me. Mm. And there's hundreds of us, if not thousands, all around the world, some of whom go off tea after like 15 years.
You've provided the most definitive evidence anyone could ask for, I suppose you could say.
Yeah. And there are now some studies actually being done. Like there's one in America that was just been done by a fertility clinic in Boston to actually back this up as well, which is really useful. So yeah, we shouldn't be told that. And we also shouldn't be told things that go on the side of that, like trans men are told that testosterone increases their chances of certain cancers, so they should have a hysterectomy after so many years on T. There's also no evidence for that. So a lot of trans men have these hysterectomies and then have to go through a kind of retroactive grieving process for their fertility because they might not have even realized they could preserve their eggs. And then they have a hysterectomy under false pretenses of this heightened cancer risk. And then they realize none of that is true. I mean, that's huge. Yeah. So it's really hard to bring attention to it. We're trying to draw attention to what's going on and hopefully sort of through community spreading awareness, people like me don't have to go through that process of understanding the truth sort of just in time almost.
Yeah, a lot of people listening won't be aware that there have been any trans men who have given birth, I think it's fair to say, but across the world, there are a considerable number by the look of it.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. As usual with these things, there's no stats because people like me are usually invisible. But there was one interesting, in Australia, they record gender for every section of the health service. It's kind of a quirk. It's not like a trans-inclusive thing. It just happens to benefit us. But that includes pregnancy care, right? So they just, by accident, recorded the fact that in, I think of like a three-year time span, 257 or something men gave birth in Australia alone. So that's this one thing we have.
Yeah, that data is an accidental consequence of the way that they log it, which makes you wonder what those stats would be like if every country deliberately did do that.
Yeah, for sure.
I was reading a brilliant Guardian article that I think came out around the same time as Seahorse, the film, if people aren't aware, really brilliant film about Freddie's pregnancy and birth. But it was an article about it, and they were saying that there's lots of first men to have given birth in the UK because this is so secret, no one knows about it.
Absolutely. It's like if you go to a conference about trans health or trans pregnancy even, which there are a couple now that exist, that's everyone's opening joke. I was the sixth first pregnant trans man, blah blah blah, you know. It's a bad joke, but yeah, we can't help it.
I suppose it's partly because the press love headlines like first trans man gives birth.
Oh, yeah.
They're happy doing that every 5 years, even if it's not true.
Oh yeah, they've got no reason to tell the truth or help us spread awareness for the kind of actual problems that the community faces, which is a constant frustration.
Of course. But,
yeah. The media not being honest or helpful. I can't believe it.
Oh my.
We often start off, we've kind of diven. What's that? Dove? What do you say? Dived? We've dived. That's the word.
I'm happier with dived. I definitely don't think diven is going to get us anywhere, probably.
Well, considering we've diven straight into the centre of that, let's take you all the way back. We often ask people about their first brush with masculinity, what masculinity looked like to them and what it felt like. Can you explain that a bit for you?
Yeah, I was having a think about this and I was sort of thinking about who were the men that I first looked up to. And I thought that's not really quite right because I don't think I was aware of that being linked to masculinity or even the concept of masculinity in a positive sense from a young age. Mm. And then I realised, oh, actually, I think the first time I was made aware of masculinity was through being bullied. And I'd sort of forgotten about that. And at school, I just remember being told, if you didn't do dot, 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 you wouldn't be so masculine. Or just, why are you so masculine? Why do you wear those shoes? Why do you stand like that? Literally, I remember being told by a boy in my year and probably like around 14, 15, if you didn't stand like that, you wouldn't look so manly. And like, I hadn't done anything to provoke him saying that. And I always remember feeling a bit blindsided by this commentary that I was given about myself that I didn't really understand. I knew it was meant to be shaming, but to me, I felt this weird mix of like shame, but also affirmation. Even then, this is way before I ever heard of the terms trans or, you know, knew that was a possibility. So yeah, I was, you know, made aware of the idea of masculinity as being something I needed to avoid, but felt like it was clearly just some inherent part of me So like, oh my God, there's a problem there. And I just didn't really know. No one to talk to about it kind of thing.
It's an odd thing how often these problems come up out of nowhere. We've had a number of people answer this question with similar stories of unsolicited feedback. Like if you didn't stand like that, if you didn't play with that thing, if your feet were turned out, all this sort of thing. And as you say, they're very rarely in response to something you've asked. We seem to have a tendency to just compulsively comment on how well or otherwise people are living up to what we think they are.
But then I think also lots of the guests we've spoken to tend to sort of think of it in a way that they have been doing something wrong that doesn't make them masculine enough. Whereas it seems like you're obviously getting the flip side of that, which is really fascinating. And that there was behaviors that you were exhibiting, probably unconsciously at the time, that seemed to quote unquote masculine. When did you start to kind of go, right, actually, this body isn't right for me. I need to change the outward side of me. Yeah. How did that kind of start to develop?
I mean, really, that only occurred to me when I realized it was a possibility.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Which was when I was at university. Yeah. I think people find it hard to wrap their heads around or maybe like empathize with, and it's a cliche obviously, but you know, you cannot be what you cannot see. Like how could you have got to the age of 24-ish, I can't remember exactly, without realizing that there was such a thing as a trans man? Or but like we also really quickly just forget how quickly things have changed.
Yeah.
And the fact that a concept literally did not exist. And the idea of a transsexual was like something offensive that I won't describe, but just a joke basically, or a pantomime dame or a drag queen or someone who was like definitely kind of mentally ill and bad in every conceivable way and scary and not someone I ever wanted to be associated with. But yeah, like the other side of that just couldn't imagine it.
Yeah, I don't think that the verb transitioning and everything that goes with that has been in common use for more than a handful of years, really. I don't think you'd see it in the press or in popular accounts of culture or anything. And if we don't have words for things that are in everyday use, as you say, we don't have concepts.
Also, I think with trans men, there's this added layer of stuff you have to push through because like strong girls or butch women are kind of celebrated to an extent, like not always, obviously. And, you know, there's huge problems that the lesbian community faces, but it's not like when you are a feminine boy and you're constantly made to feel like what you are is wrong and you're maybe pushed along that path of self-discovery a bit sooner. Like I just got told I was a tomboy and I got constantly told I was a lesbian and I knew I wasn't attracted to women. I've always been attracted to men and still am, although now I'm sort of a bit more fluid in that kind of space. But I was just like, none of this makes sense to me, so I'm just going to ignore it. I mean, when I was very young, I used to proudly talk about growing up and having a sex change, but probably around the age of about 6 or 7, I got the strong message that that was a really embarrassing and weird thing to say. So stop doing that.
Doesn't play well in the playground, that sort of thing.
No, not at all.
Not at that age.
Yeah. So then I just sort of thought, well, more people feel like me, but I'm not going to talk about it. And then I had friends who were sort of tomboys who then got to their teenage years and like discovered femininity to a greater or lesser extent. And I just never did. And my mum would say things like, you know, it'll happen. Like, don't worry. You know, she was always very affirming and supportive. So again, I think that stopped me from going any deeper. And then, yeah, by university, like I hadn't changed. I was still the same person. And one day I was on an early version of YouTube and saw a pirated documentary about a trans boy in the US and my head exploded. And that was it.
And of course, that is part of the media as well. It's easy for us to talk about it negatively, but it's also kind of astonishing to think that you needed YouTube to demonstrate that your existence was a thing, basically, was valid.
Absolutely.
How did you find the social transition of it personally? I mean, seeing people start to perceive you as who you've been this entire time and starts to use the correct pronouns and starts to, I suppose, treat you differently because you are now presenting to the world as a man. How did that play out for you?
It's a funny one. That's a really interesting question. That's not a period of life I get asked much about. And actually, it's not very well understood. I think we hear a lot in media commentary about trans people having to go through a number of years of sort of proving that they're trans to doctors before they're allowed to access medical treatment. And I had that same thing, although I think for me it was a little bit shorter because when I arrived at the gender clinic and also being trans male as opposed to trans female, it was fairly easy for me to exist in a very masculine way. So like when I got to the gender clinic, they were pretty happy with how I was presenting and you know, how I talked about myself, and I was sort of passing with flying colors, which is kind of how it feels because you really feel like you're being tested. So there was only about 6 months to a year where they said, okay, well, this is all great, but what you need to do now is to come out to everyone in your life, change your name and come back in like 6 months time, and then we can prescribe you tea. And that then triggered the most nightmarish 6 months of my life where I had to tell everyone that I was a man and expect them to completely change the way that they perceived me and referred to me and everything without me physically changing. I mean, I was sure of myself and I'd always felt the same about who I am. I'm also shy and an introvert and socially awkward as all hell.
So you didn't relish the task of suddenly dropping a bombshell on basically everyone in your life without any actual, as it were, hard proof of it?
I just felt we're all going to have to like play along with the idea that I've somehow changed when actually I haven't changed. Yeah. And I know how difficult it is. I'm like an empathic person. So I just would die of cringe every time someone had to speak to me differently. And yet I hadn't gone for it. It's kind of hard to explain, but I basically went mute for about 6 months because I could sort of pass as long as I didn't speak. Mm. And I was terrified of making people feel awkward. It's also like very British, right? I just don't want to make a fuss. And lots of trans people talk about this. I wish I could just go away for 2 years and come back and have transitioned. And then like, it would be easy for everyone.
Meet everyone as a new version of yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. I wouldn't have to go through this awfully awkward second puberty / transition process in front of everyone. And not only do I have to do that, but I have to do that in a way that I can kind of prove to my doctors, you know, oh, it was just horrendous. Yeah. And then when I started to, you know, it was all okay again. I mean, one of the crazy things I did was like, I went to Afghanistan for 6 months when I was waiting for my first gender clinic appointment because, well, at least if I'm in Afghanistan, I'll be worrying about other things than my gender and I'll be amongst strangers for a while.
Basically, the task in front of you was so extreme that you preferred just to take yourself off to Afghanistan.
I mean, yeah, it's weird. I did Arabic at university, so I've been in the Middle East a fair bit.
Yeah.
And obviously, Afghanistan is not the Middle East. But people talk about, you know, when you're a foreigner in those kinds of countries, you're kind of this weird third gender anyway. Because if you're being perceived as a foreign woman, you know, you have different privileges, as it were, to like local women and also different ones to local men. And so,
sure.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, but I found it easier.
Yeah, it took you out of the arena of men do this, women do that, which was going to be extremely hard for you to be in.
Yeah.
In that situation. It does make sense. It's just, as you say, quite an extreme solution.
And actually, while I was there, I told my boss what I was struggling with. And then he was like, well, why don't you socially transition here? And that was weirdly quite simple because also when you have really strict rules for what men and women do in other countries, yeah, that was like totally cool as well. So I actually did also socially transition while I was out there and started teaching boys instead of girls. It was quite a kind of clear delineation and no one had a problem with it, which to this day I'm still amazed by and very grateful for. But yeah, that was a pretty tricky period of my life because also there's a lot of doubt when you want to transition. I think people who aren't trans need to hear that trans people are just like 100% constantly sure of who they are and they never worry about anything when it comes to transition.
Yeah.
And that's just not true. That's just not accurate. And it wouldn't be a fair thing to expect of any human being going through a massive life change. Yeah. So, you know, I wondered a lot whether I was, you know, if this was the wrong thing, I mean, people would just reject me and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a really stressful time.
Mm. And presumably that is fueled by the messaging that's out there that, you know, this is probably just a phase. And you hear this a lot with reference to trans kids and, you know, oh, you'll change your mind. All this stuff seems to be everywhere.
100%. It's the worst kind of gaslighting. You're like, I don't think I'm ever going to feel differently about myself. I haven't in the last 24 years. But if I do, it sounds like it's going to be the worst possible thing. Jesus, it's totally unfair.
In the face of all of that, and after 6 months of mutism, how do you start building yourself up again?
Well, I would say the period after that hard period was as incredible as the hard period was hard.
Right.
Because yeah. It didn't take much. Once I had that testosterone in my system and really quite quickly realized, oh, yes, this is right for me. Oh, yeah. This is really right for me. Like, oh, my God, I feel incredible.
Brilliant.
And my voice is dropping and I sound like I feel like I should sound. I look like I feel like I should look. And I'm noticing changes that are really subtle and that no one else is really noticing. But I'm noticing partly because I can see strangers are very quickly reading me as male, which is a really interesting thing in general. I think we default to male as humans in general, and then we kind of change when we see obvious signals of female. And that was no longer happening with me. And so I didn't really have to do anything or make any effort after that point because I just discovered this confidence and was getting all this feedback loop of affirmation of, wow, this is incredible. And yeah, I had lots of online community, other trans men that I could look to. I suppose that's probably the first time in my life I actually feel like I had role models. Yeah, sort of thinking about role models when I was younger, I couldn't think of any. But now I can, and they're kind of all within the trans male community.
Yeah, it's not surprising. It may be a question which is difficult to ask to someone that's trans because almost by definition, you haven't seen role models when you were growing up because that's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah.
It comes back to this thing of not being able to be what you can't see. It makes much more sense that you have role models now at a stage of your life where you are on a path that is the actual path of you, of your personality.
But it's funny because that is so obvious in a way, but it's not something I realized until I really thought about it just now. Because I did have people who I kind of idolized when I was younger, like actors and musicians and writers, and they were all male. But I didn't understand my relationship to them. I didn't understand whether I wanted to be them, whether I was idolizing them, whether I fancied them. It was so confusing. So yeah, it's only really now that I'm able to sort of understand my relationship to other people in general.
That's a really interesting concept, yeah, actually, in terms of queer men. The book Call Me By Your Name is kind of all about the idea of when you're attracted to men, is it because you physically fancy them and love them, or is it that you want to be like them? Do you want to emulate them? Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting dichotomy. I've not quite fully fleshed out my thoughts on it, but it's nice to hear someone else say it, because you kind of think, oh, I'm not the only one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a way in which there's this universal queer experience, and then there's sort of subsections of that for different kinds of queer identity. And yes, I can totally relate to that now as a queer man, but before I realized that I was a queer man or could be a queer man, I couldn't access any of that or feel like it was actually a real experience I was having, as opposed to just confusion.
It's very interesting. And I think, as a sort of cis straight girl that wants to empathize as wide as possible with everyone, I often think about this term dysphoria and how I can understand it best. And I've seen you say that it's near impossible to define it, but maybe the root of it is something like...
I thought you were about to say it's impossible to articulate. Can you give it a go?
Yeah, I think having read that it's impossible, I won't put him on the spot. But it feels like maybe the core of it is something to do with this idea that you are aware there is some other identity which ought to belong to you, but you don't yet know of its existence. It feels like that might be quite close to the definition, longing for something which you cannot name because you don't know even that it is there.
Yeah, definitely. Words like disconnect, that is a really good word to sort of start a conversation about it. But then when you try to give examples of what that feels like, you just sound... Well, it's not surprising in a way that people just thought that being trans was a mental illness for a long time, because that's the only ways we have to think about that kind of thing. And I think basically I feel like there's a different category of experience that trans people have that doesn't have any analogies or good comparisons. But because trans people aren't taken seriously, it's very hard for society as a whole to allow for the idea that there is this completely discrete new experience that we have. So, and then especially when you have anti-trans voices belittling that and making it sound like, oh, I'm not a woman because of some essence or because of some feeling. And it's like, well, you can say it in a way that makes it sound stupid, but trans people are telling you that that's what they experience. So maybe we're not lying. Like,
yeah.
Also, it's kind of helpful to think about gender euphoria as the opposite.
Yes, the sense of being completely at home with the gender as assigned to you. I mean, the thing is, this all makes complete sense to anyone that's looks back over the history of human experience, because we'll see that most of the experiences discrete from the mainstream start off as being seen as mental illnesses, basically. Mm-hmm. In the same way that any form of depression or anything like that used to be seen as essential madness. At one time, we only had a pretty crude idea of someone being mad, someone needs to go to an asylum. All those things covered what we now understand as dozens of separate strands of human experience. And this feels like another example of that, which is slow to catch up with the fact that there are things that we don't yet have terms for and fully understand.
Yeah.
And the easiest thing to do is just dismiss that as someone's brain not working properly.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also why it's so painful that trans people and feminists are pitted against each other in this totally false way. Because, you know, obviously you look back on the history of women's health and you have hysteria, the idea that of not being taken seriously. So that's totally a shared experience that we have with cis women. So yeah, it's painful when they can't see that we're fighting similar fights and that kind of thing.
I was really interested, well, both in Seahorse and in lots of stuff about your pregnancy, about the kind of, it's not a dichotomy, but it's a social one that everyone has in their heads of pregnancy and giving birth as being something that defines womanhood. How did you process that personally, knowing about your manhood and your masculinity? How did you handle that dichotomy, which doesn't exist, but that we have made exist?
Yeah, I think, again, it's a dichotomy that doesn't allow for the existence of trans people.
Yeah.
It makes total sense if you think that trans people don't exist and that that's how we thought about it. Well, I don't want to overstate that, because at the same time, I would say that there's been a long history of feminists writing about being anti-essentialist and anti-biological essentialism and anti sort of saying things like women are defined by their bodies and what their bodies do. And so
absolutely,
it's not radical from a feminist perspective to say that's not a helpful way of seeing things. And, you know, often we trans people will take sort of transphobic arguments about womanhood and point to like women who don't have uteruses or, you know, women who can't give birth. And it's hard, I think, for people to get their heads around that, because it seems so extreme. It's like, well, literally what you're saying then is that someone who doesn't give birth is not a woman. If giving birth is what defines womanhood, like, it doesn't make any sense, right, even without trans people. But once we know that trans people do exist, then we can just listen to them when they talk about their experiences. And it doesn't need to change the way women think about their experiences necessarily. You know, if a woman wants to think that giving birth is like the essence of her womanhood and that all this sort of stuff, it's kind of woo-woo and I would say, you know, earth mothery type stuff, not my place to say she can't do that. Nothing to do with me.
But it's an odd thing underpinning a lot of transphobia, isn't it? That people seem incapable of thinking this has got nothing to do with me. An awful lot of people who are transphobic seem to automatically assume that their own experience is undermined by the existence of your experience. That seems to be what unites transphobia.
Absolutely. Yeah, and they conveniently ignore that there's plenty of cis women out there who don't think of pregnancy as the essential woman, not the essential feminine or the essential anything, or, you know, and who kind of hate pregnancy. And there's lots of, I guess, like subversive ideas about all this stuff that, again, exist without trans people.
As you say, many feminists have made the point that the social imperative to have and look after babies is one of the things that's held back the progress of women for, well, forever. So given that, it's a bit weird to weaponize the right to give birth as a thing that women lock up and make all the, you know, it'd be much simpler if we talked about people just each being able to do what they wanted, you might think.
Yeah, there's loads of different angles to it. There's like bodily autonomy. There's like the reality of being trans, which is like the majority of trans men don't have genital surgery, and that's for a whole variety of reasons, including the fact that the surgeries are extremely complex and lots of people just literally cannot access them. It's kind of crude, but I always like to point out that if giving birth is me not living as a man, then what am I doing every time I go for a wee?
Yeah.
You know, like, and what is every trans, well, not every, but the majority of trans men doing every time we use the bathroom if we haven't had lower surgery? Am I in that moment not living as a man, but then I'm living as a man again when you can see me and you read me as a man?
It's like Schrodinger's wee, isn't it, really?
If you will, Michael, yes.
Indeed, yeah.
I think I've seen you say in interviews that you didn't have to grapple with this while pregnant as much as one would expect, because people simply did not assume that you could be pregnant. People's brains can't put together the idea of man and a pregnancy, so they just thought you were a big guy.
Yeah, not even a big guy particularly, because I actually carried really small, which was kind of a blessing because it just kept me safer and made it easier for me to still go out. And but yeah, I think even if I hadn't carried small, people wouldn't have read me as a pregnant man, because what even is that? You know, sort of. And I'm not sure if that would have changed now, even with greater exposure of pregnant trans men in the media. I think on a day-to-day basis, it would still be really unlikely for a trans guy who was pregnant to be read as such.
Yeah.
And yeah, like nothing about how I felt changed when I went off tea and got pregnant. So I think people often assume that pregnancy for me must have destabilized my identity and that blah, blah, blah. It wasn't that at all. It didn't do any of that. That's kind of an external projection of ideas onto the subjective experience. What was difficult for me was people constantly telling me that, oh, that must be what I'm experiencing. No.
Yeah.
And being in a kind of world that is constantly gendered feminine and female. Mm.
It doesn't really make sense that people think that it would undermine your own sense of identity, because you chose to get pregnant, right? You deliberately went about that.
And there isn't some essence of femininity or femaleness that comes with the experience of pregnancy any more than there is of like being a woman in general. That's sort of a weird way to think about gender. Yeah,
it is. I was going to say, presumably both the process of being pregnant and then the actual process of childbirth, and we see this in the film, it's not as if, I mean, that didn't make you feel like a woman, obviously, from what you're saying. It just made you feel like the person that you had set out to be, a pregnant person, because it was something that you wanted.
Yeah, I just felt like me doing a thing. I think people, again, it's like, because people have only ever seen women give birth, they then mistake that for, oh, you must feel like a woman when you're giving birth, whatever that means. And it's just not the case. But I understand. I'm not going to resent it, but it's pretty exhausting. And yeah, I'm just so grateful for the growing community that now exists of seahorse dads, as we call ourselves, because the male seahorses carry and birth their babies. Because yeah, that's grown a lot in the years since I had my first kid, and now I'm pregnant again. I feel very differently about it. And there's like tons more people I can look to who are setting examples of how to be out and proud about it.
I was just going to ask, I didn't know whether to bring it up, but yes, you're having another kid.
Yeah. I didn't know that I definitely would, but I told myself that it would be like two and done, because what I find difficult is being off testosterone, not so much the pregnancy. Uh-huh. If I could be pregnant and on T, I'd feel much more like myself. And so I think it wouldn't be half as hard, but obviously that's not possible because it would be dangerous to the growing baby. So I'm off testosterone, and it took me a while longer to conceive this time, which was also really stressful. But thank God this community is now more active, and I'm just finding the whole experience a lot less isolating than I did the first time.
Can you describe, just again from the point of view of near total ignorance, when you say that being off it makes you feel less like yourself, is that purely to do with just physical changes that happen, or is it more than that?
I can't tell you, to be honest.
You might not know, I guess.
I don't know.
Fundamental, yeah. It's very interesting.
And this is not a universal trans male experience, I should say. You know, it's very common amongst trans men to feel like how I feel, but it's also... there's plenty of people who don't feel this way. And there's guys who stop tea for all sorts of reasons, ranging from kind of medical to financial, or like maybe going on to a really low dose, like kind of microdosing. So yeah, I cannot tell you why this makes me feel like myself. I mean, the physical stuff helps in a sense that I can see a more true reflection of who I feel I look like in my head when I look in the mirror when I'm on tea. And again, there's really subtle things that only I notice. But in terms of just like... the vibe. I can't explain that.
I'm not surprised in a way. If these things were easy to explain, then you would have had a very different life.
Christ.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We spoke a bit further back about how you feel like you have role models now when you didn't when you were younger. Who are they?
So first and foremost, it is those other dads who have literally taught me how to be public and how to advocate.
Could you tell us their names? Just for people who are listening might want to know their names.
Sure. So there's one friend in the UK in particular. I mean, there's more, but there's one guy who was pregnant at the same time as me the first time around. And it's funny because he's not at all in the public eye. His name's Jacob. I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying, but he's not at all out there. But in terms of him, it was just showing me how to think about things in a different way. He told me that he never meets new people and lets them think that he's not the person that gave birth to his daughter for more than about 5 minutes. Whereas I generally don't share that information unless it's relevant or unless I get to know someone more. And so that made me question, why do I hold back on that front if my friend Jacob can just be like, hey, this is me and I made this. So don't think anyone else did this because this is my hard work and all that kind of stuff. I was just like, wow, you are incredible.
It is hard work, to be fair. You should claim it.
Exactly. So like, what kind of internalized transphobia was I carrying there? So he's been an incredible personal role model. And then there's a guy called Danny in the States who taught me about a lot of bodily pride. He shared a lot of photos of his bump when he was pregnant. He also taught me a lot about what it means to kind of raise a child in a more gender creative and gender neutral way, which helped me think about it in a totally different way to the way that it's often talked about sensationally in the media. A guy called Bennett in California, a guy called Caden. Caden actually was the first person who ever introduced me to the idea of trans male pregnancy. Again, just by accident, I just stumbled across it on YouTube. And he was pregnant with his first daughter, like at least 5 years ago now. He's recently had another one. Those are the guys. And there's so many more as well that I follow on Instagram and I'm aware of. Yeah.
It's great because many times when this comes up, inevitably the role models are people in the public eye because those are the people that are fed to us as role models as we grow up. It's kind of inspiring to hear you derive inspirational examples just from a community that's forming, which hasn't existed for past generations.
Absolutely.
You said one of the people there was helping you kind of think about parenting in a gender creative way, but single male parenting, we don't see lots of it. How have you found that? And can you explain what you mean by gender? gender creative and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the solo male parenting thing definitely was also a bit of a thing I had to work through in terms of carrying within me sort of an internalized homophobia, I think, and ideas about parenthood and becoming a parent, you know, helped me realize things like it's parenting that matters, not mothering and fathering. And there are so many aspects of parenthood that we gender unnecessarily.
Yeah.
I read a book by a single adoptive gay dad, which I think he wrote in the 90s. I can't remember what it's called, but that was transformative for me. And there's a lot I can relate to amongst that community of sort of gay single dads or solo dads by choice. So I'm hugely grateful to the dads that have gone before me and like figured all this out a few decades ago now. And then, yeah, gender creative, gender neutral parenting. I just, again, that's something I only kind of really realized the importance of as I was becoming a parent. I thought people who raised their kids as they, them, and to be honest, that they were a little bit extreme. And I thought they were raising their kids to be non-binary. And I was like, well, that doesn't make sense because statistically speaking, my kid is not going to be trans. But when I became a dad, I then realized the kind of massive onslaught of gendering that my child was going to be up against for the rest of his life. And I was like, oh God, I get it now. Like, all you're doing is just protecting them. You're trying to kind of hold back the tidal wave of stereotypes and expectations that are placed on these tiny humans from before they're even born. And it's well-intentioned because I think we want to feel like we know our babies and we want to create characters for them and stuff. But that was a huge awakening for me. And I read this book called Parenting Beyond Pink and Blue, which was hugely affecting. And yeah, so now I'm like, do you know what? I'm probably going to mostly use gender neutral pronouns for this second kid, because if there's anything I can do to save them from gender stereotyping and let them figure out who they are in a truly free way, then I will do that.
Yeah, you're not trying to push them down a particular path. It's the opposite. You're trying to opt out of this very binary fork in the road, which is shoved at people, as you say, right from the outset.
Yeah.
One of the things that set into my head, I read this article about gender neutral parenting, and it was about giving the child a choice. And I think that's what people forget. It's not saying they're going to be raised as non-binary and they'll end up being non-binary for the rest of their lives. It's saying when you're old enough to say that I would like to be this, then the parent goes, great, cool, we'll call you this. And I thought that was a much easier way of understanding what that kind of gender neutral parenting meant, was that it's not saying they'll never have a gender, it's they'll have the gender that they identify with and they'll tell you what they feel like. Is that right? I think that's right.
Yeah, absolutely. And it might be more of a mosaic of different characteristics that we don't usually, because I think also when people hear that idea of like, this kid will tell me who they are when they're older, it's like, they'll tell me they're a boy and they like blue, or they'll tell me they're a girl and they like pink.
Yeah.
It's not about that either. It's like you are hopefully equipping your child to be the person they were really meant to be and the fullest person they could be. And there was that BBC documentary a few years ago that showed that adults played with babies differently according to whether they thought the babies were male or female.
Yeah.
That is wild to me.
Yeah.
So much of this is unconscious that we struggle with to get our heads around how much we are doing it and we feel defensive about it, which I think is really unhelpful.
Yeah, stuff about people hold the baby facing them more if it's seen as one gender or the other, and I think talk to, in inverted commas, girl babies more.
Yeah, talk to girls.
Stuff
more.
Like that. It's just quite amazing, as you say, really, when you think about how little agency the kids that size have got in any of these decisions.
Yeah, and it's really quite a recent thing, weirdly. Like, throughout the last few hundred years of human history, up until about the 50s, 60s, 70s, babies really were babies, and it was considered very, I don't know, uncouth or uncivilized to gender a baby. So they all had, like, white dresses and long hair.
Yeah.
And then it was only with, like, the dawn of marketing and consumerism that gender for kids really was invented.
Because it was lucrative.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. You just sell more stuff.
It's not just Santa that became red because of consumerism.
Indeed.
Yeah.
The idea of a mosaic of characteristics sort of leads quite nicely into our final question.
I thought that might be the segue that you used, and I liked it. Liked it a lot.
But it is. It's a nice way of thinking about it. We used to call it Build-A-Bear, and then Build-A-Bear just didn't give us a sponsorship. So I'm now going to take mosaic of characteristics from you.
To be fair, we never asked Build-A-Bear for sponsorship. We just thought that if we mentioned them enough, it would sort of fall into our laps.
But I do still feel personally slighted by it.
Resentful, yeah.
Yeah. But in terms of mosaic characteristics, we look at three qualities that you might build into the ideal kind of person or vision of masculinity, if that's how you'd like to take it. Do you have three characteristics? I mean, it's quite interesting to ask a parent, I suppose, because it's sort of what you're doing, right?
Well, yeah, that was my first thought. Well, I kind of am building a man. But yeah. Then I was like, no, I'm not. Because any parent will know that you have actually very little control over who your kid is and, you know, what they're into or what they're going to do.
I can only agree with that, yeah.
Right. Yeah, we were at a service station the other day and my kid only wanted an ice cream. And then when I finally gave in, he said to me, I'm glad we've made a decision on this.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've seen that sort of tactics.
Right. It's free. It's terrifying. But I could say the things, I mean, certainly, again, going back to that gender neutral parenting thing, I really hope that my kid does have, I was trying to like think of what this quality is and whether it even exists, because like, I'm not sure there's anything that could really bring a child through childhood unscathed by gender stereotypes and expectations. But maybe there's a kind of confidence that a kid could have that would allow them to be themselves no matter what. And obviously there are some people who grow up to express really different kinds of identities with gender or creativity or whatever it is. So I guess like whatever that is that enables someone to remain true to themselves.
Like a confidence in yourself rather than a self-confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. A sense of self and a sense that being yourself is great and wonderful and positive. And especially, you know, when we're talking about boys, whatever it is that turns them into like sexist little bastards when they become teenagers, being able to withhold that. And then with that, the next thing I thought of was a healthy questioning of authority. That's what I'd want. Because I think when it comes to like masculinity, you have to question a lot of what you're told in terms of your male privilege and what being a man means in this world. And yeah, if a boy can do that, then hopefully they'll kind of be okay.
That's a really nice one, actually. Not one we've heard before.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Questioning the norms seems more important than ever, really, given how much toxic use of authority and of platforms there is.
Yeah.
And tied to the first one, it's sort of saying, is that who I am? And is that what I want? And if the answer is, yes, I do want that ice cream at that service station, then fine. You question that authority as much as you need to, if that's who you are.
Indeed. Exactly. A constant learning experience. And then the last one I was thinking, what I wish I'd had as a kid, which was just, well, actually, it probably comes back to self-confidence or like just sort of being motivated and being curious. And yeah, I really, really lacked confidence to a sort of catastrophic degree as a young person. And that's obviously partly to do with not knowing who I was and being constantly second-guessed and gaslit by the world. But I think a lot of young people go through that. So yeah, I wish I hadn't kind of had to wait until the age of 30 to feel confident and to be myself and then to go after what I wanted. So I'm not sure what our third one is, but something like that.
Curious, I've written down curious.
Yeah, curiosity is good.
Yeah, curiosity.
I think that the sort of work that you're doing and chats like this will enable many more people to find what they actually want before the age of 30. That's the hope.
Hopefully, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming and joining us, Freddie. Do you have anything you'd like to plug on your, you'd like to send anybody to have a look or a read or anything, really?
Could I say, firstly, buy Sean Fay's book, The Transgender Issue. If you want to understand any of the other media, political stuff, Sean has done it for us.
Yeah.
And she's an incredible writer and mind.
It's an incredible book, actually. I'm midway through it and I'm trying to savour it because I want to like absorb everything that's been written down. It's amazing.
Yeah, I have it with me away here and I'm really looking forward to reading it myself. Yes, and then also I have a kid's book coming out next year called Little Seahorse. It's being published by Puffin and it's about a seahorse papa and his kid, and they have a conversation about what it takes to make a family and what people really need, quote unquote, sort of making an allusion to this idea that kids need a mum and a dad, and actually they don't. But what do they really need? So it's a cute little story about a family that looks like mine.
That's amazing. That sounds so brilliant.
Yeah, that's great.
Comes back to what we were saying earlier about you can't be what you can't see. And if children can see books like that, then it shows there's more possibilities for them than there are limitations.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Freddie. And I'll be looking forward to reading that book.
You'll get through that pretty quickly, I reckon, Michael.
No, you never know.
Suitable for adults as well.
No, thanks a lot, Freddie. This has been great.
Good. Yeah, I really enjoyed this chat. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And that was Freddie, as we promised, a fascinating conversation. Really, really wonderful. And Freddie's new book called The Little Seahorse and the Big Question is coming out next year. And I think you can pre-order it in various places. Try not Amazon. Try an actual bookshop if you can.
Yeah, and I would say, as an author, that pre-orders are enormously welcome because they boost the book's general standing. And also they make you feel as if some people in the world care about the thing that you spent absolutely ages doing. So do get behind Freddie's book. A really valuable thing for any kid to read.
Yeah, it's really lovely, actually, having had Juno on. Oh, gosh, my voice just went there. Sorry.
That's because your life of sin, my voice, catching up with you again.
It was really lovely having had Juno on last week and now Freddie on this week, and both are doing some amazing work in getting queer characters into young adult fiction and children's books and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, really gorgeous.
They have. And I've noticed that because of the sort of listenership we have, every time we say things like, do support this book or this event, is that people genuinely do it. You see it on Twitter and it really is gratifying and warming, I think I'd say.
Also gratifying. gratifying, actually. We were together in Newcastle at your gig last week, and there are a couple of Menkind listeners who turned up, so hello to them. That was lovely to meet them.
Yes, and if you think, oh, I wish I'd been there, that must have been a hell of a time with those two guys. You can see 10 minutes of our conversation on Patreon, where we put a half-time chat, didn't we?
We did indeed. I can't remember what we said, to be honest. I had a couple of rums, but it was a lovely time.
Oh, we talked a lot of crap about dubbing versus subtitles and all sorts of other business, but it was the longest piece of nonsense we've ever put on Patreon, I think. So if that's your sort of thing, you can find it at patreon.com/ Menkind Podcast.
Yes, and where can they find you doing comedy, Mark?
Well, tonight I'm in Bath, but I say that before anyone is listening to this. That's the most useless bit of plugging I've ever done.
Yesterday I was in Bath.
But be aware, I have been in Bath. there are so many dates coming up. And as you say, I have had the pleasure of seeing a couple of Menkind listeners. Once again this week, I met some in Devon. The simplest thing to do is go to markwatsonthecomedian.com, and there is a daunting looking list of gigs there, and there will pretty much be one near your home unless you have chosen a strange place to live. Oh, no, I suppose there are places like Orkney and Shetland. If you go far enough to the north of Scotland, that's a lovely place to live, but I'm not going there. Almost anywhere else is covered at some point.
Next week, we have the lovely, brilliant, gorgeous, funny Susie Ruffle, who is also a podcaster. We absolutely adore her, don't we?
Yes, and has a very successful, at least one successful podcast, as far as I know. So it'll probably be another one of these situations where we feel a bit sort of cowed by it, because she's not just a good guest, but she seems like she knows how to do podcasts better than us. But there we are. That's happened before. It'll happen again.
But in the meantime, have a lovely week. And a plug from me, if you see me and want to hand me a Barocca and a glass of water at any time this week, that would be very much appreciated.
There we go. Come and see me. Medicate my...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Cool. We'll see you next time.
Bye.